From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. President Obama wants to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Insourcing was a theme of his State of the Union message. And we're going to hear now from a CEO who opened a plant in this country recently. James Curley runs Keen, K-E-E-N, the Portland, Oregon company that makes footwear, bags, and socks. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
And in 2010, you opened a plant in Portland to make work boots. I've read that it employs 30 people. I want you to run us through a bit of the calculus that made you decide to open domestically rather than, say, in China.
Sure. I mean, we're an eight-year-old company born this century, so we looked at all the technical dimensions that we deal with, and that can be areas like duty rates, it can be transportation costs, it can be intellectual property, it can be development cost. And when you put it all together and you look at it in the context of what we need for our business and our brand and our products from a costing perspective, it starts to make sense. But the broader picture is looking at the dynamics, what's happening over in Asia and other parts of the world where we see labor rates increasing at a significant rate. We also see vertical integration of our factories being closer linked to commodities and materials that basically tie us into some deals that might not be in the best interest of our product build or our product business.
But you still make most of your footwear in Asia. Does this logic change that? Well, should we expect to see some of that production and some of those jobs coming back to the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, we've already started, and I think it's the classic, you know, one small step for insourcing in America and one giant leap for Keen, where we decided to embark on a new category that we call utility, which is our steel toe shoe. So when you think about a category of steel toe, you think about built in America, you think about Americans building things. But also what we recognized was when it comes to intellectual property and innovation, beyond the technical cost of the product, the cost of protecting your brand and some of your innovation is becoming increasingly more important. So
I'm surprised that you attach that much importance to intellectual property. I remember asking the manager of an American shoe plant about 25 years ago, how long does it take you from the time you steal the design in Paris to the time that lady's shoe is on in shoe stores? And the answer wasn't very huffy. It was a month to 6 weeks. I thought the shoe business is all about taking other people's designs.
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to new categories and trying to, you know, say to our fans that we're going to bring you breakthrough innovation, we have to make sure we can control that innovation. And also, I think there's the balance point of innovation and quality control. So by building a factory here in Portland, Oregon, we were able to say we completely understand labor dynamics, overhead dynamics, the shift from manual to automation. Mm-hmm. And as a result, not only for our own factory, but when we speak with our other sourcing partners, we're much more educated to be able to make better decisions and in the interest of, you know, cost reduction and quality improvement.
Are we reaching a point where automation and computerization of production has reduced factory workforces by so much that wage differentials just don't matter that much anymore? If it's only 30 people, what's the big deal?
Yeah, I think we're getting there. And this always sounds a little controversial, but one of the challenges that I think we see on a, you know, global economic level is that sometimes when labor's too cheap, there is no incentive to automate to improve productivity. So the kind of vision we had was, can we improve the quality of the job, the quality of the labor, and actually introduce some automation to improve productivity? And what we're finding is that we're starting to see that balance point already at our factory in Portland.
You speak of the fan base. I went to the Keen website, and there's an ethos to your company. You talk about hybrid lifestyle, and this has to do with work and recreation and integrating our lives. Do you think that means that actually for people who buy Keen shoes or boots, the fact that it's made in America, you think will actually be a plus? It's a marketing advantage to you.
I think to a certain fan, they actually do connect with the fact that we're a young company and we're trying things. And just the fact that we have an effort and a very real business and brand effort that creates product in America, I think is important.
Well, Mr. Curley, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I appreciate it.
It's James Curley speaking to us from Portland, Oregon, where he is the CEO of Keen, which opened a factory in 2010 in Portland.
It was 5 months ago that a town in Vermont was walloped by the remnants of Hurricane Irene. Waterbury sustained millions of dollars in damage and lost revenue for businesses there. The floods brought by Irene receded long ago, but Waterbury's future is still uncertain. Vermont Public Radio's Lynn McCrae reports.
Out on Main Street, a church bell still chimes daily, But daily life in Waterbury hasn't been the same since Tropical Storm Irene.
It's palpable. You can sense that it's not as vibrant as it was.
Bill Shepelock is Waterbury's municipal manager. He says about 200 properties in the village were hit by flooding, nearly a third of all its homes and businesses. But for residents, that's not the worst of it. For decades, 1,500 employees worked at the sprawling state office complex along one end of Main Street. But Irene's floodwaters inundated all 49 of the century-old red brick buildings. All but one of them was rendered uninhabitable. That meant almost all those workers had to go to temporary offices elsewhere. They still haven't returned. Bill Shepelock says the town felt the loss immediately. 1,500 people who were once in and out of restaurants, grocery stores, and dry cleaners are now gone.
You know, every job has a multiplier. So every dollar of payroll maybe translates into $7 or $8 or $12, and that dollar just gets circulated through a community.
More than half of Albert Caron's customers were state workers. His auto repair shop is just a block from the state office complex, and work has dropped off dramatically.
I have nothing scheduled for next week after. Near lunchtime, usually I can probably figure out anywhere between 8 and 10 walk-ins. Now I'll get one if I'm lucky.
The irony of Waterbury's situation is that the town was in tough straits 30 years ago when the state mental hospital occupied the buildings that have since been converted to the state office complex. It was that transformation from state hospital to state offices that triggered the town's renaissance. At Waterbury's Winter Farmers Market, Mark Hall says residents in this close-knit community have been trying to support village businesses.
The community is great. I mean, we do everything we can, but there's not enough of us to keep it going the way it was going before the flood.
The state has been studying whether it's financially feasible to renovate some of the aging buildings at the Waterbury complex so workers can return. The question now is, how long can the village wait? While many businesses struggle to hang on, people in town are fighting back. They've created Rebuild Waterbury, a nonprofit, to help push along the recovery process.
People are really, I think, committed to the community.
Amy Hoskins volunteers at the farmers market. She says before Irene, the town was just hitting its stride with the addition of things like a wine bar and a performing arts studio.
So it had become sort of a more thriving, lively place in the last few years. And to have Irene hit us when it did has really set us back.
Like many others in town, Hoskins is hopeful that Waterbury's resilience will carry it through this new challenge. Municipal manager Bill Shepelock sees it as a challenge the town will rise to.
You know, the old adage is you have to adapt or you die. And we're in a position where we have to accept there's going to be change.
Meanwhile, the town looks ahead to March. That's when state government expects to make decisions about whether any state workers can return to Waterbury and when. For NPR News, I'm Lynn McRae.
And today, the Federal Reserve is taking another step in its stated intention to become more transparent. The committee that sets interest rates ends a two-day meeting, and its usual post-meeting announcement will have some unusual information. For a hint of what we're to learn, we called David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the Fed going to announce today that's so remarkable?
Well, for the past few years, the Fed each quarter has been telling us what each of its 17 current policymakers think will happen to the growth of the economy, to unemployment, and to inflation. But there's one thing they've kept very close to their vests, and that is the one thing that the Fed actually controls directly. What the Fed officials expect to do with the short-term interest rate, the target rate that sets the rate that cascades through the economy over the next year. Today, for the first time, each of them will say where they expect rates will be.
And would you know exactly where they're going to tell us rates will be?
Well, the Fed has been keeping this short-term interest rate at zero since December 2008, which is extraordinary. And it's told us that it expects rates to remain there at least through the middle of 2013. The betting is that when we see the new information today, that they will tell us it's more likely that rates will be at zero through 2014. And more interesting, maybe, they're going to tell us in what year do they expect to raise interest rates. The Fed's hope is that by giving this additional information, they'll reassure investors and borrowers and consumers that rates are going to be low for a very long time. The Fed doesn't have an itchy trigger finger, and they hope that'll encourage people to borrow and to make investments in bonds and stocks and other things, knowing that short-term rates aren't going up.
Does that mean this will actually happen?
No, it's not a commitment. It's not a promise. It's saying our best estimate of what the economy is going to do leads us to think this is what we're going to do with interest rates. We are seeing what's going on inside the minds of the Fed officials, but they're going to go out of their way to say that it's not a promise and it's not a commitment.
Now, is there a downside to the Fed broadcasting where it plans to keep rates for the next few years?
Well, some Fed officials think so, and some analysts on Wall Street think so, for a couple of reasons. One, the public and investors may not understand that the Fed is not making a commitment, and if the Fed changes its mind later because the economy is different, that could cause a backlash. Secondly, they may be limiting their flexibility. Will they be more reluctant to raise interest rates sooner because they've made the statement? And a third risk is that we won't be getting a consensus of the committee, but we will be learning what 17 different officials expect to happen in interest rates. And there's a risk that this creates a cacophony, that it confuses people rather than clarifies things.
So how big of a shift is this really, back to the whole question of them having in previous years kept this very close to their vest? How much of a change is this for the Fed?
Well, it's part of a continuum of changes. When I started covering the Fed didn't even announce when it was moving interest rates. You had to discern that from what it did in the markets. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan prized flexibility. And in order to be flexible, he was secretive. He never wanted to say exactly what he was going to do. That allowed him to do whatever he wanted when the time came. Ben Bernanke, the current Fed chairman, is very different. He believes that monetary policy works better when people understand what the Fed is thinking and what it expects, and this is another step in that direction.
David Wessel is economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, David.
You're welcome.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn G. Wax, will be with us once again. She'll be fact-checking the economic portions of the president's speech. But we have more now with White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett. She's one of the president's closest advisors. She's a key member of the team. She was with the president at the State of the Union address last night, and she's with us from the White House. The president also said that he will fight obstruction with action to get his plans for the economic recovery through, or another plan that he feels are essential to help the country. You know, a lot of Republicans are saying that this really wasn't a State of the Union address last night. This is really the opening campaign speech. To the degree to which the president does continue to make unilateral moves, say use his recess appointment power and things like that, do you have a concern that that will just further inflame feelings on Capitol Hill, that it will make it even harder to get things done legislatively, even where there are opportunities to work together in a bipartisan fashion?
Well, you have to look at the stakes, Michelle. The stakes are very high. You mentioned recess appointments. A couple of weeks ago, the president appointed Rich Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Why did he do that? He did that because under the Dodd-Frank legislation, an integral part of that legislation was to make sure that for the first time, we have one agency whose sole responsibility it is to look out for the consumer. Well, the Republicans in Congress oppose having that entity. They didn't want to have a consumer watchdog. And that's why they opposed Rich Cordray. Not that they had any concern with him. In fact, Rich enjoyed bipartisan support among his colleagues when he used to be the Attorney General of Ohio. And so this wasn't an issue of there being a concern about Rich. It was their objecting to the principle that we have this policy in place. And what the president said is, look, consumers all around this country have suffered as a result of not having rules of the road. We need a person who's going to be looking out for the consumer. The other component for why this was so important to appoint Rich is that a part of the provisions of the law didn't go into effect until you had a director of the agency. So they were unable to regulate, for example, payday lenders. They were unable to regulate mortgage brokers. Some of the bad actors who had such a terrible impact on the consumer throughout this economy. And so I think the short answer to your question is the president's focus is not on politics. His focus is on what is important for the American people. The election is months away, but we can't afford to wait until then to look out for the people who have been so disadvantaged by all of the bad acts that took place a few years ago that led to this economic crisis.
The president also again introduced the idea, as he has before, of the need, as he sees it, to raise taxes on the richest Americans. He raised again the question of the fairness of the tax rate for someone like Warren Buffett being lower than for Warren Buffett's secretary, who actually happened to be in attendance last night, or not happened to be, who was in attendance last night.
You invited her, yes.
So how do you respond, though, to the Republican argument that this plays into the narrative that Democrats are more interested in raising taxes than cutting spending?
Well, the president was very clear last night. I think he's absolutely committed to reducing our deficit. And I think the point he made last night is, look, we only have so many pots to look to. And if we want to bring down the deficit, we have to restructure our tax system. We also have to restructure it because we have to make it more fair. And so if we really want to, for example, encourage manufacturing to come back to the United States, well, that money has to come from somewhere. And the president made the point, Michelle, that, look, we celebrate success. That's what America's all about. Entrepreneurs who can start a business in their basement and have it grow into a global company. That's exactly what we want. But that entrepreneur didn't do it alone. They hired a workforce that was trained by our public schools. They use our roads, our bridges, our railways, our internet, all which was created by government. And government is there to do what the private sector can't do. Many of our advances in science and technology were seeded through government. And that's his point, is if we really want to be a world leader, the world leader that we are, if we want to maintain our competitive advantage, we have got to figure out how we can bring down the deficit yet invest in business. And so if you think about all the different pots that are available to you, isn't it only fair that those who've done so well pay a little bit more? And I think the reason why he invited Debbie to be a guest in the box is because she's really a perfect example of somebody who works really, really hard. And is it fair that she pays a higher tax rate than her boss, Warren Buffett? Warren Buffett doesn't think so.
I'm speaking with Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to President Obama. And, of course, we're talking about last night's State of the Union address. You know, another area where the president laid out a clear philosophical difference with the Republicans in Congress and also many leading Republicans around the country was around energy policy. And, of course, this has been, you know, a very hotly debated issue. The president decided not to go forward with a pipeline, you know, from Canada. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who delivered the Republican response to the president's address last night, talked about this. I just want to play a short clip of what he said. Here it is.
The extremism that stifles the development of homegrown energy or cancels a perfectly safe pipeline that would employ tens of thousands or jacks up consumer utility bills for no improvement in either human health or world temperature is a pro-poverty policy.
Clearly, the argument is forming that the president is not taking advantage of opportunities for economic growth like this pipeline, and it makes the argument that creating jobs as a number one priority rings hollow to people like Mitch Daniels. How do you respond to that?
Well, let's talk about the pipeline. The fact of the matter is, when we were negotiating the extension of the payroll tax, the Republicans put the pipeline on the table. And they tried to force the president to make a decision under a timeline that at the time the Secretary of State said very clearly that they had not completed their environmental review. And Secretary Clinton said before the payroll tax extension was passed, do not give us a deadline because we will not be able to meet that deadline. And if you do, then we're going to have to turn it down. So they had, the Republicans had all the warning in advance that if they set this arbitrary deadline, we'd have to turn it down, as opposed to just letting it go through the normal process and perhaps approving it, perhaps reconfiguring the route. I mean, there were a whole range of possibilities, but they precluded any of that by insisting on this drop-dead deadline. And I guess the question is, what did the pipeline have to do with extending the payroll tax in the first place? And the other point the president made last night about continuing to extend the payroll tax, which is so important for 160 million Americans who depend on this, $40 a paycheck is a big deal. I was sitting next to a woman last night who had written in about what she would do with her $40, and she explained to me how important that is to her just to get by. And so why would we burden that piece of legislation with other pieces of legislation that aren't germane?
And finally, Valerie Jarrett, obviously there are many, many things we could talk about. We haven't at all even talked about the foreign policy, and I regret that. But before we let you go, I wanted to talk about another proposal that the president has announced last night that he said would allow homeowners to save around $3,000 a year by refinancing their mortgages. The reason I'm bringing that up is, once again, the criticism from the left is it makes a good press release, but the policy really isn't there. The money's not going to be there. Members of Congress aren't going to support this, so that's really for show. And it also replays into a Republican narrative that the president's already had 3 years to put his ideas into practice. It hasn't turned the economy around, so this is why it's time to give somebody else a chance.
Well, it's time to go back to the practices that got us into this mess to begin with. I mean, what the Republicans have been saying is, let's get rid of the rules of the road. You know, let's not hold banks accountable. And what the president is saying is, look, the housing crisis, not only has it hurt so many individual families, that is having a devastating impact on our economy and a devastating impact on the families involved. So let's forge together and figure out a solution. And so there are two different perspectives. Do you want to get rid of the rules of the road? Do you want to let everybody just do whatever they want to do? Or do you want to really look out for the consumer, look out for the American people, and figure out ways to create and foster an environment where companies want to double down on America? We had a meeting here at the White House a few weeks ago where the president invited companies from around the country who had outsourced jobs outside of the United States and then made the decision to bring those jobs back. Well, we need to be encouraging that. We need to be investing in manufacturing and small businesses. We need to be creating a workforce where Americans can compete in a global marketplace because they have the necessary skills. And we need fairness, and we need a sustainable, strong economy that's durable for the future. That's the president's vision. That's what he outlined last night. In the days and weeks ahead, you will see considerable more detail than he could possibly contain in one speech and flesh out all of the different policy programs that he announced last night, and look forward to engaging with the Republicans, because the American people, Michelle, they expect the elected officials who represent them to take action. And the president's strong message last night is he's going to take action. He's willing to work with anyone in the chamber. He's also going to do everything within his power and in the executive branch to move our country forward.
Valerie Jarrett is senior advisor to President Obama, and she was kind enough to join us from the White House. Valerie Jarrett, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Have a great day.